Two people came up and after this talk on pain, and with quotes. And one person, I don't know who it was, just left me one. Another person read me a quote. And I think they're kind of appropriate to go after this topic of pain. And the one that was read to me went like this. It's a quote by Pir Vilayat Khan, a Sufi teacher. Overcome any bitterness that may have come because you were not up to the magnitude of pain that was entrusted to you. Like the mother of the world who carries the pain of the world in her heart, each of us is part of her heart, and therefore endowed with a certain measure of cosmic pain. You are sharing in the totality of that pain. You are called upon to meet it in joy instead of self-pity. And then the other quote was, being compassionate to yourself, you reconcile all beings in the world. So I wanted to talk a little bit this evening about compassion, because it seems it's a very important topic for, especially after talking about pain, but it's a very important topic for any Buddhist. Buddhism is the two wings that support Buddhist practice are insight, wisdom, and compassion. And I realized in my own practice, after the fact, many years after the fact, that in the early years of practice, there was a time when compassion was a very important quality or emotion or state that supported my practice. But I didn't really realize it at the time. And what happened was, there was a period of time, a few years, where I would see the expression or manifestation of compassion outside of myself. I just see it everywhere. I would see it in other people. Certain people just seem to be the embodiment of Avalokiteshvara. And Avalokiteshvara is, or Kuan Yin in Chinese, is the Buddhist personification, the Buddhist deity of compassion. Maybe the Sanskrit name is Avalokiteshvara. And in Chinese they know it as Kuan Yin. And in Japan it became Kannon, or Kanzeon, Kannon. And then in America we use it all the time. We use the Canon camera. Isn't that? The name Canon camera comes from the name for the personification of compassion. Because the personification of compassion sees the suffering of the world. So you... So I would see it in people. Certain people seem like they kind of projected my needs for compassion on these people, just to see this embodiment of compassion. And I see it in objects in the world, like sculptures and sculptures that years later I realized had nothing to do with compassion. I thought it was kind of an abstract expression of Avalokiteshvara, of compassion. And I just saw it all over the place. And I think that what was happening was that I needed a lot of compassion in my practice at that point. In my early years of practice, there was a lot of difficulty that I had. I saw, what came up for me was I saw a lot of my fears, my feelings of guilt, my feelings of inadequacy, of lack of self-worth, and my angers, my pains, just, you know, just like all the stuff started coming out. It's kind of like a purification process, and all the stuff begins coming to the surface. And I wasn't doing mindfulness practice. I wasn't like so completely conscious of all this. I mean, I just allowed it to happen and was present for it, but I wasn't engaged with it in the way we are with mindfulness practice. And maybe because I wasn't so engaged in it in a conscious way, then my unconscious was finding all these expressions of compassion to surround me with, to make it kind of let those experiences come up into my awareness in a field of compassion. And I've known other practitioners who had even more dramatic experience of finding manifestations of compassion. There was one man I knew who, sitting at a seven-day retreat, a Zen sesshin, at some point in the middle of the sesshin, the seat next to him was empty. And at some point in the middle of the meditation session, this white-robed deity of compassion manifested herself next to him. And the Zen master kind of poo-pooed, you know, that. And just, but I think it was, you know, that's what he needed as a companion at that moment. It was just, his mind created it as a projection. Or another friend of mine who was traveling from Kathmandu to India on the buses. And if you've ever taken that route and been on a Nepalese bus, going down these windy roads in the Himalayas, you realize that your life is threatened. And so she was petrified, holding onto the railing of the seat in front of her on the bus, and thinking for sure, looking over these cliffs, and for sure that this is going to be the end. And then manifesting herself on the seat next to her was Avalokiteshvara, was Kannan, telling her that things were okay, things were going to be fine. And kind of in moments of dire necessity. And compassion is very important because compassion provides a wider perspective within which we can receive or be present for our neurosis, our anger, our sadness, our depression. All these things are seen in a larger context. You don't no longer see your sadness or your anger as the whole show, kind of that you pull the curtain and that's the play, but rather you see that the whole thing is happening in a sea, an ocean of compassion. And I think all of us, when we first in our practice, but especially when we first beginning to do our practice, need to have a lot of compassion for ourselves, because if you don't, you're going to have a lot of bitterness or a lot of anger or a lot of extra suffering, because all of us will meet things as we practice about ourselves which are painful or unsavory? That's a good word. What other good words? Unexpected. Unexpected. That's a polite word.
Distasteful.
Distasteful things, yeah. Things you don't go home and tell your mother. To be able to see these things as just a human phenomenon, have some compassion for ourselves or for those things themselves, can make the whole experience a lot easier. And there's no reason not to have compassion. But having said that, it's not so easy to create it or produce it. But as the practice deepens, as mindfulness practice matures, one of the things we learn is that our hearts are always larger than any problem that threatens us. And if we can learn to trust that wider heart, then we can allow the other things, the problems, the difficulties to arise and to be there, because you know the heart is bigger. The heart can hold them. The heart might cry, might break, but still it'll hold them. When it breaks, it just cracks a little bit. It still holds it all. So in Buddhism, the two wings of Buddhist practice is what's called in Sanskrit prajna and karuna, or in Pali panna and karuna. And these are usually translated into English as wisdom and compassion. But I myself prefer to translate panna or prajna not as wisdom but as insight. Because in the way that it's discussed in Buddhism, it's more of a way of seeing the world, of perceiving the world, of relating to the world, than it is wisdom in the sense maybe of wisdom being knowledge or understanding. So I kind of a little bit prefer the word insight. So the two wings are insight and compassion. And vipassana kind of means, more or less literally means, clear seeing or clear insight. And so we focus a lot on insight practice. And sometimes I think it can be fairly faulted on for us, so people can criticize us for it, for not talking enough about compassion. Because they're equal. They need to be equally balanced in the presentation of Buddhism, in the practice of Buddhism, in our own practice. But we talk so much about the insight side. In part because out of insight arises compassion. But I think we need to kind of remember that both wings have to be there if the practice is going to fly, if the practice is going to kind of go smoothly. And also, these can be tied to the two gates or doors of liberation. There are one of the doors of liberation is, or the Pali words, is one of what is called panna vimutti, and the other is cetto vimutti. Vimutti means liberation. Panna means something like insight. And it's the liberation that comes from insight, from understanding. And the cetto means something like the heart. And it's liberation that comes from the heart. It's a transformation. One is a transformation of our understanding, of our insight, of our seeing. And the other, cetto vimutti, is the transformation of our emotions, the emotional transformation that can happen through the practice. And both can happen. Sometimes they happen, you know, one or the other happens kind of, they happen kind of, one happens without the other. But to be balanced, it's best to have them both. Insight grounds and stabilizes our emotional life, and then allows our emotional life to transform, and then this emotional transformation then in turn creates a soil or ground or compost for further development of insight. Wisdom and insight, wisdom and compassion go back and forth and support each other. Wisdom without compassion can be cold, indifferent, sometimes aloof, and there might not be any motivation to act. One of the primary motivations for acting in Buddhism is compassion. There are other reasons to act, but the primary, most fundamental motivation for any kind of action is compassion in Buddhism. Compassion is the open... Is there a question?
I'm just going to ask you, what is compassion? Now you say it.
Compassion.
Allowing or accepting, or I'm trying to find out what it is.
Yeah, I'll get to it a little bit. Well, compassion is made up of, I think of it as two parts, two aspects to what's meant by karuna. And one part means it's being empathetic, feeling empathy for suffering, whether it's for your own suffering or suffering of others. So where the heart or your tenderness, your sensitivity is open enough so that you can sense and feel the suffering of the world. That's one half, is the feeling of empathy. The other part, and very important part of Buddhist compassion, is the motivation or the desire to alleviate that suffering. And that's where the motivation comes from, is the desire to alleviate it, to feel it honestly, and then to desire to alleviate it. So that's what compassion is, and wisdom can be described in many ways, but one is the wisdom begins as recognizing or opening to and respecting all our capacities, all the functionings, all the states of mind, all the things that might arise. Our fears, our hurts, our feelings, and those hurts and feelings of others also. Being willing to recognize them. Being willing not only to recognize them, but willing to be present for them in the way that we often talk about here. And one of the contributions that Buddhists, I hope, can make to the world is from this kind of practice, is a willingness to be a witness, a willingness to be present in the midst of suffering. Because it's so easy to turn our backs to it, turn away from it. Not really to be present, to numb out. So that wisdom brings the ability to be present, and compassion is that openness that happens when we're present for the suffering. To be present and then open and responsive to that situation. But without some kind of wisdom, without some understanding or deeper insight into the dynamics of suffering, you won't understand the causes of suffering. And part of the function of wisdom is to understand the root causes of suffering. And compassion by itself doesn't have that understanding. And one of the important things to do in the presence of suffering is to listen very carefully of what's really going on, what are the dynamics, what's under it. If we only have compassion and don't have that ability to listen and be still a little bit, look deeper, we might misunderstand the situation and respond inappropriately. I have this quote from a woman named Ruth Sanford. She wrote when visiting South Africa in 1987. A compassionate person, seeing a butterfly struggling to free itself from its cocoon and wanting to help, very gently loosened the filaments to form an opening. The butterfly was freed, emerged from the cocoon, and fluttered about, but could not fly. What the compassionate person did not know was that only through the birth struggle can the wings grow strong enough for flight. Its shortened life was spent on the ground. It never knew freedom. It never really lived. So it's important to have some understanding of what we're being compassionate for. And then, as I said, without compassion, it's all too easy for our understanding to be indifferent or lack the motivation to act or respond. I spent a year in the monastery reflecting a lot about what was behind my desire, my intention to be of service in the world. Reflecting on the purity of my wish to be of service to others through the Dharma, through Buddhism, and other ways also. And I had different options, different choices, life choices to make. And one of them was between throwing myself into Buddhism and responding to the suffering of the world through Buddhist practice. And the other was to go back to graduate school. And I had been accepted to UC Berkeley in the Department of Soil Science. And because of my undergraduate degree was in agriculture and agronomy, and I was very sensitive to the issue of soil erosion. It's one of the major issues in the world. Very few people think about it, but it was as important, I felt, in 1980 as the nuclear issue was in 1980. And the amount of devastation, destruction is happening to soil and erosion. And most people don't know about it. And I felt, well, I have the training and I have the ability to go back and train some more and try to respond to the suffering through that very important area. So I spent a year and I didn't really trust my intention. I didn't really trust people who wanted to be of service so much or help. And I didn't know what was behind it and what was I trying to get from it. And I spent a year thinking about it. At the end of the year, I thought it was okay to have that intention. And that it came from a place that felt sincere. It came from some integrity. And one of the things, besides discerning that, I also felt that if I had gone into soil science, into work on soil conservation, soil erosion work, that I might have been very helpful to people. It might have helped a lot. But my decision at that time was that I felt I never would be satisfied, because in bringing people food or good soil or whatever, I felt I wasn't really going to touch or confront or meet the deeper levels of suffering that all human beings have. And even though lack of food is a fundamental suffering and we should respond to it, maybe because of the years of practice I had done, I felt that it would be kind of I wouldn't be satisfied in my life if my life wasn't dedicated to responding to where I felt the fundamentals of suffering lie. And the only way I knew how to do that was through Buddhism. And Buddhism was the only thing I knew at that time that talked about the root cause of the suffering, the fundamental clinging to self-identity that is often at the source of much suffering. And at some point, as I've said many times, at some point I believe it doesn't make sense to do Buddhist practice. I suspect any kind of religious practice if you're only doing it for yourself. When people initially come to do practice, it's often for themselves. And I know for myself, when I first really threw myself into regular meditation practice, daily, everyday practice, I wasn't happy with my life, and I wanted to make my life, I wanted to be happier. I wanted to be a more likable person and have more friends and do things like that. And I thought meditation would help. And And what happened was, after a while, that no longer motivated my practice. It no longer was an issue. And at some point, mindfulness opens up to a sensitivity to the suffering around you also. And you feel that you're not so separate from that suffering around you. And you're connected to others and connected to that suffering. That's what compassion means, feeling connected to the suffering around you. And that in some ways that suffering was my own. And that for the practice, for me to continue practicing, I couldn't just practice in isolation anymore, but my practice had to be for others also. And then practice becomes immense, and it has no end probably, because there's a lot of people out there and a lot of suffering, and more people get produced all the time. And so you get a sense that your practice is something you're going to do forever because of this feeling of connection. In some schools of Buddhism, they focus on the virtue of compassionate altruism at the beginning of a person's practice. It's one of the first things you're introduced to. And part of the reason for that is that the only way you can sustain a long-term, lifetime-length practice is to feel that somehow your practice is connected to other people also. And so they do exercises, they do meditations on developing this kind of compassion. In other schools of Buddhism, including in our school of mindfulness practice, there isn't that effort to cultivate altruistic compassion early on, but rather allow it to arise in its own good time, which it usually does, or you stop practicing. So it often arises naturally in its own time when one's self-preoccupation gives away to a sensitivity to the wider situation we live in. And self-preoccupation with one's own suffering is okay. What we're learning in this practice is to be responsive to suffering wherever we find it, and without too much concern whether it's inside or outside. And if you can learn to be responsive, learn to hold the suffering, your own suffering, in a wise way, and learn to see your reactions, your responses to your own suffering, and the way we complicate it, and you go a long way to understanding how to receive and be present for the suffering around you. So it's okay to be self-preoccupied at the beginning of one's practice. We kind of expect people to be. And because we're kind of, that's where the practice of compassion and insight and presence is being learned. Elaine.
I feel so strongly that I had no idea what compassion was until I developed a little bit for myself. That I think it was just wrong and misleading to even talk about it vis-a-vis other people until I had learned to see it in me. And what I learned out of being able to see what needs compassion in me is also the sort of thing that keeps compassion from being sympathetic or interfering. I noticed that in response to a friend who had lost a child, I was able to get in touch with my own suffering vis-a-vis that and do much more appropriate things for her than if subliminally I was trying to make myself feel better. I'm just overwhelmed with how important that is all the time for me to be compassionate with myself. It keeps a little bit of a clearer insightfulness, and it's magic.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you. Yes.
So I think this is along the same lines I wanted to bring up in this. I think it was a poem or a quote you wrote about, you read about compassion in the end. It said something about self-pity. And I just want to say, I'm glad you musicians, it's okay to be self-preoccupied or to really feel compassion for yourself, because I consider self-pity actually a judgment. And that's my own sense about it. And I don't even think it has a place next to compassion, because if you truly have compassion, then even if you want to call it that, I'm not even quite sure what that is. It's okay to feel whatever that is you might feel for yourself and not judge it as self-pity.
Oh yeah, for sure. Self-pity is considered to be the near enemy of compassion, because self-pity can look like compassion. And the near enemy is that emotion which is masquerades or gets confused for something virtuous, a virtuous emotion. So self-pity is that. And self-pity, as you said, involves a kind of distance from others, separation from others or from yourself. And compassion doesn't have any... Part of what Elaine said is that also is that if you understand your own suffering, understand that you do suffer, and you really have come to grips with it, then you realize that you're kind of equal to someone else, that you're not so separate from them. And so when the other people are suffering, it's not like you here and them there, and it's their suffering, and you're kind of, you know, this separate being who's offering kind of goodwill or offering kindness or whatever. You feel somehow much more connected and equal to that. And so you recognize in yourself. So there's often with self-pity or kind of false compassion, there can be a kind of superiority. Oh, I feel so sorry for you. And kind of looking down and, and they start giving advice from that place. But if I think if we see, if we really have honest about our own level of suffering, then I think compassion can happen much more healthily for others. And so maybe the word self-preoccupation wasn't a very good word to have chosen, because in our English language it has kind of a negative connotation, that expression. But I think that to be focused on oneself, to understand oneself really deeply, is what happens in a big part of what meditation practice is. And to really learn how to work with your own suffering then is a bridge to learning how to be present for the suffering around you. And if you haven't done that work, you end up with a kind of relationship to suffering in the world around you which is unhealthy, which is can be problematic.
What does it look like?
Problematic?
Yeah, unhealthy.
Unhealthy. One is... one unhealthy way of responding is that someone's suffering out there, and there is some kind of, you feel some kind of empathy, you feel that it's painful to be present in that suffering. And then rather than focusing on that person, you become completely preoccupied with what the pain that you're feeling and how it is for you. And so then you start doing this, forming this whole kind of drama about how to protect yourself and what you need, or forming this resistance or defensiveness, because you're focused on your pain around the situation and not the suffering that person is experiencing. And when the compassion is clean, there's no resistance to it, no defensiveness to it. You feel it's okay to be present for it, and we don't complicate it. Yes?
I have a question about if someone brings up that fear and you have an aversion to them because you don't have enough safety within yourself to open to their pain.
Yeah.
I think that for me it's taken a while to realize that when I get into that, it's really hard not to be judgmental about myself.
Beautiful. That's what this other quote said. Overcome any bitterness that may have come because you were not up to the magnitude of pain that was entrusted to you. I mean, compassion is always the right response to yourself. So if you find that you're not. I mean, part of what mindfulness practice involves is seeing our imperfections, seeing our shortcomings. To be a human being is to have shortcomings. I think it's a matter of definition almost. Show me a human being doesn't have shortcomings. And so what relationship you can have to that, to your limitations? One possibility is you can beat yourself up. And that's the common choice. But it's not very useful. And much more useful and healthy is to have compassion for yourself and know what your limitations are. Know this is all I can take. This is all I can stand. And know that compassionately. And then from that, maybe choose to withdraw. That's a lot different than not seeing it, being angry with yourself, being angry with the situation, setting up all these walls and kind of walking around in a huff or whatever we do. So we have to recognize our limitations and have profound respect for it. And yes?
Are limitations based on a comparison with other people? And if I let go of, and it's a judgment.
Well, maybe to some degree, but I mean, if we're talking about compassion and suffering, if someone's suffering, and it's, you know, clear that they need help, and you really want to help, but you feel that you're not able to because you're afraid. I mean, you feel there's a problem, and I guess, you know, maybe the judgment then would be, You know, I'm not up to it, or I could be better, or someone else, you know, I'm comparing myself with someone else who could have done something, and therefore I'm not. I could see there's some comparison can come in. But rather than comparison, it just, judgment gets in the way. The judging mind. And if we don't judge, if we don't judge ourselves a lot, then there's less need for compassion for ourselves. So there's two routes you can take. One is to hold it all in a compassionate embrace and let the judgment kind of melt. Or you can just give up your judgment and you do whatever one's easiest. And if you can't give up your judgments, then just shower yourself with compassion. Yes?
I have a question about wisdom and compassion. In my visit to the Himalayas, there's a lot of symbols of the sun and the moon. And my guide explained to me that the sun is the male principle and the moon is female in many cultures. But also that the sun is compassion and the moon is wisdom. And it was kind of a nice shattering of preconceptions that the male principle is compassion and the female principle. Do you think there's anything underlying that relationship?
I've noticed that too, that in India, Indian Buddhism and in Tibetan Buddhism coming out of India, that wisdom is female and compassion is male. I don't have any ideas about that. But what happened when Buddhism went to China was compassion was transformed into female. So this Avalokiteshvara technically is a male, but Kuan Yin is usually considered a female. So when I use the word Avalokiteshvara, I call him or her, because I think of compassion as being kind of a female kind of deity. But some of my Buddhist scholar friends who don't like it when I write in my papers her, when I refer to Avalokiteshvara, because she's a he. But I don't know. Do you have any ideas?
Well, it was nice because it broke my list of preconceptions.
Sophia, Santa Sophia, is also a female. It's also wisdom. So there are some Western precedents for wisdom being feminine.
The goddess Athena is the goddess of wisdom.
Wisdom. So when did wisdom become male? a few decades ago? Yes?
A thought comes to mind as you were talking earlier about how judgment interferes with compassion. And a lot of times I find myself in, like, say, a confrontational situation with another person. And I'd like to try this out as a thought, and that is that what I find myself being involved in is a judgment move, some form of reinforcement towards this confrontation, essentially fueled by judgment, self-judgment, judgment of the other person. I thought that what was particularly valuable about what you were talking about at that time was that to bring compassion in sort of diffuses that you allow yourself to withdraw from that place. Thank you.
When suffering arises in the context of mindfulness practice, there are various ways that students can respond in a complicated situation. One is what's called a sideways glance. You don't really want to deal with the suffering, but you realize in mindfulness you're supposed to kind of note everything, acknowledge everything. So you kind of look off the side, oh, there it is, and kind of note it and go back to your breath. You know, so you've done your duty and kind of like you're holding it at arm's distance. And that's one way. And the other way is not to hold it at a distance, but actually to engage yourself with it, but to engage yourself with an agenda. You want to do something, you want to get rid of it. And so you're going to try to tinker with it, or you try to use the laser light of mindfulness to kind of dissolve it, or whatever. Or you're going to use, compassion. You're going to use compassion to get rid of the suffering because you can't stand the suffering. That's not really what the practice is. Both the practice of compassion and the practice of mindfulness is to allow what's there to be there and hold it in awareness or hold it in compassion and then see what happens. Not to hold it in compassion or hold it with awareness in order to get rid of it. It's a very important distinction. Also, I have a poem about the moon. This poet, Japanese nun, Izumi Shikibu. Watching the moon at dawn, solitary, mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. I think that's kind of hopefully what we come to in this practice, is to know ourselves completely with no part left out. So compassion doesn't make us a victim of suffering. Some people feel victimized by suffering, and they confuse compassion with what's been called horrified anxiety or fear. But compassion doesn't make us a victim to suffering. I think it helps us really to discover life. And I think there's a tendency for many people to think that the purpose of life is an ever-ending pursuit of pleasurable activity or pleasurable things. And my experience, my sense is that to really feel alive, to really feel human, is to feel all parts of being human. And if I didn't feel the suffering of myself or feel the suffering of the world, I'd be less human. And even though I don't particularly like feeling suffering, I'm very willing to be it's not exactly pleasant to be in suffering, but it's life. It's where, I wouldn't want to be without it. We discover life there. And this is important, I think, is that as we discover our own suffering and have compassion for it, and as we discover suffering around us, one of the shifts of perspective that happens to people is that they realize that suffering is a universal fact, and that there's a shift between being preoccupied or being focused so much on one's own suffering to realizing that one's own suffering is part of a whole ocean of human suffering. And there's a wider context for it, in a sense it almost loses some of its personal quality to it. And you're just and feeling that connectedness, that your suffering is connected to the suffering of the world, can make it a lot more manageable to be with your suffering. We realize that it's not our own private, isolated pain. It belongs to the great stream of suffering, which is a universal aspect of human life. Our shared history of grief and sorrow. So I'll end with a few poems, quotes. This is a poem by William Stafford called Tragedy. It happens. You knew it could. No one ever said it wouldn't, and now it has. The world just goes on. The air moves. The trees keep on standing there. And maybe grieve a little, the sun stays steady. All of this can't stop for a person, no matter who, and the whole world has to rock now and then, but that's all. So people come by to talk and help, if they can. They shake their heads helpfully. You'll get over it, they say. And maybe, after years, you do. Or at least some of the time, when it's quiet or during music, you almost do. And then there's another poem by the same Japanese poet, Izumi Shikibu. Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight also leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house. The image that when the heart cracks, it makes room for the light to come through. And then finally, from the Dalai Lama, love and compassion are necessities, not luxuries. Without them, humanity cannot survive. With them, we can make a joint effort to solve the problems of the whole of humankind. So I appreciated the discussion and the comments. It would have been nice to have had more to hear from you. And maybe at some point, one of these Mondays, we can have a more discussion on compassion. It's very important, and so hopefully it's a little bit more on your mind. It's been on my mind for the last 4 or 5 days, and it's great to have it on my mind, thinking about it or reflecting on it. I recommend to you picking up themes sometimes and carry the themes with you around for a week. So thank you all, and I'll see you in August.
Where are you going for July?
I'm staying home.
How come you're not coming here?
I'm going to work on my dissertation.